We'll call the meeting to order with the people who are present. Members, today we are going to be having an overview of the ACA, the federal change legislation that we've seen come down from Washington. This should be a good opportunity for us to learn more about the impacts, particularly to Minnesota. One of the themes we've been talking about here in this committee and elsewhere is the desire to preserve Minnesota's lead as a health care reform state, one of the healthiest states in the nation. We score higher than the rest of the nation in a number of key factors, and we don't want to ruin that as we watch and work with the federal legislation as it's coming forward. So today's an opportunity to learn more about the ACA and its impacts on Minnesota as we talk about how we want to reform health care in the state of Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Liebling for requesting this presentation and am pleased to bring it forward. When we have a quorum, we'll work on minutes, but right now I'd like to welcome Dr. Stephen Parente to the committee. Dr. Parente, if you want to just mention your name and your position for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Steve Parente. I'm a professor of finance at the Carlson School of Management and at the University of Minnesota.
Very good. If you want to proceed with your presentation.
Sure. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about the Accountable Care Act, Affordable Care Act, excuse me. This legislation, as we all know, is one of the most sweeping pieces of legislation that has come through in the last quarter century. It has profound implications for the country as well as the state of Minnesota. What I intend to do here today is to give you an overview of the law as passed in different segments of where it has major points of impact for the state of Minnesota and the country. That's the first half of the presentation. And then after going through some of the different components, and then what I'd like to do is talk about more specifically the financial impacts of the law as projected by the Congressional Budget Office and other components, and then talk more specifically about Minnesota opportunities that are possible from this legislation. So I understand that it is as many of you know, it's a very large bill. It's 2,700 pages. One of the reasons why it was so large was much of it had to overwrite or to coordinate with a lot of existing legislation that is already on the books with the federal regs. And as we'll see when we talk to things more specifically, such as insurance exchanges, it has quite a sweeping impact in its implementation. So before getting into this, I need to give a little, I guess, background or level setting just on my own background. I am trained as a health economist. I've been working as a health economist for the last 20 years. I've been at the University of Minnesota for 12 years. Prior to that, I was working at the Project Hope Center for Health Affairs in Washington, D.C., and then before that, getting my Ph.D. at Johns Hopkins. Even prior to that, I worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield of the Rochester area. Rochester, New York, was known, as Minnesota is known, as being a reform leader. Rochester, even though it's somewhat of an adopted hometown when I lived there, my opinion rested on its laurels. It's a good illustration of how a community actually lost the lead in terms of being a community that was talked about quite a bit during health reform in the 1990s, and pretty much today is not talked about at all. The other Rochester, the one south of us, is talked about far more than the innovations that occurred in that area. My priors as a health economist, and many other health economists share this, is that technology is good for society, but it's also a huge cost driver. And the reason is that when we agree to pay for a new medical technology, particularly for the Medicare program, our criteria is that the technology is cost-effective, not that it is cost-saving. And so the good news is that something will be paid for that really enhances someone's life, but it could be coming at a factor of four or five times what the additional therapy, the original therapy might be. My other concern is that nothing that has been passed actually will measurably bend the cost curve down. This has been echoed by not just myself and other economists, actually just more recently 200 economists from all walks of life, including two Nobel laureates, said the same thing. But also from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the chief actuary there, Richard Foster, more or less said the same thing as recently as last week. If you talk to a health insurance actuary and ask them what's the best way to keep the cost curve down, it's basically a tough love solution, which is everybody goes into a high deductible health plan. That design pretty much means that the deductible, if it's a family coverage, could be as high as $8,000. If it's a single policy, it could be as high as $3,000 or $4,000. My own research in this area, which now includes since 2002, about 12 peer-reviewed journal articles, confirms this. Looking at 3 or 4 years of history of information, what you will find is that the year-over-year inflation in a high-deductible health plan will be about 3 or 4%, as opposed to a regular preferred provider organization or managed care plan, where year-over-year inflation is more likely to be 8%. As we know, inflation is generally more than 8%. And if you want to go into politics and you want to go into the House, if you advocate a catastrophic insurance policy for all, it's probably, at least it has been, your surest way to ensure that it'll be a 2-year visit in Washington, meaning people do not want to be told that you need to ration your care, not so much by saying no to services, but ration it through price, through the mechanism of a high-deductible health plan. So what did ACA do? It is going to lead to basically about 32 million people getting coverage of 54 million, most of those being U.S. citizens. There's the law basically did not handle folks that were non-U.S. citizens. 24 million folks will get coverage through the exchange, mostly through a subsidy. We'll talk more specifically about what the exchange is in a second. And then another 16 million will get insurance through an expansion of the Medicaid program. This will come to this state as well. We have just signed up for the early version of this as a state. We also will see a loss of coverage, potentially because of different premium hikes from different groups that are involved. One note that I have to do to give thanks, a lot of the comments I'm going to be giving to you from here actually comes from our own state health department. They did a yeoman's job back when this stuff all flew in last year to put these pieces together, so hats off to them. Financing. Most of this will be coming through Medicare and Medicaid savings, in part some Part D discounts that have been granted from the pharmaceutical firms, some Medicaid drug rebates that are put into place, removing some of the payments that go to hospitals now to cover them when they're treating folks that are either indigent or in a critical access area. One of the biggest places for savings is going to be coming from the Medicare program that's targeted for Medicare Advantage, basically a Medicare HMO plan for seniors. In the past, that plan used to only cover 95% of typical expenses for Medicare. To get more people to go into it, in 2004, the Bush administration proposed for expenses to go up to 14% above what normal expenses would be, and the sense was that was too much money, and we sort of claw that back, which has been proposed and done in the bill. And also additional tax provisions. You may have heard of the Cadillac tax. The Cadillac tax simply is making a tax on the employee's part of employer-provided health insurance that generally comes to the employee, if it's a large employer, without any tax implications. How big is that amount of money? It's actually rather substantial. It is $280 billion estimated to be in 2010 alone for that subsidy, pretty much in the same ballpark as the mortgage deduction, if not greater than that. That we all, as citizens of the United States, take advantage of without much debate. What the Cadillac tax does is claw back approximately $40 to $50 billion of that per year to pay for an expansion of coverage through the exchange mechanism. There also are additional pieces as well, basically changing the HSA laws and having more stringent requirements on when health savings accounts can be used. Also putting taxes on the medical device industry, which in the case of Minnesota, we have seen with active support sort of to tone down that legislation from our senators Klobuchar and Franken. There is an additional tax on tanning, as well as other changes on tax deductibility. What happened immediately once the bill was passed on March 21st? The Department of Health and Human Services basically went into a rate and premium review. This is something that Secretary Sebelius has been doing quite actively. And money was made available to states to do effective planning immediately. The other thing that happened was within 90 days, high-risk pools were to be designed to be deployed throughout the country. Minnesota's high-risk pool was used as a design. Minnesota had the option to actually participate in that or keep its own plan. Some of that status is still uncertain. You know probably more about that than I. And then from other things that happened 6 months after the enactment, Basically, no lifetime limits on the plans were to be left behind. That is, typical limits used to be $1 to $2 million of lifetime benefit. That was sort of the standard in the industry. Now it's been made unlimited. That has a premium impact, but it was seen to be a concern before. Also, what is popularly called amongst policy analysts as the slacker tax, people that had if they had health plan coverage and they were families, their kids would be covered up to 26. I mean, even though they're, I guess, statutorily 5 years beyond the termination of kid, per se, or even more if you look at 18. Coverage of preventive services without cost sharing would be in place. No pre-existing conditions, exclusions for kids under 19. And no one can be thrown out of a plan. That's what rescission means, unless there is a market case of fraud. Now, to make all this happen,
I'm going to interrupt you just for a moment. We do have a quorum, members, and so I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes. So moved. Representative McDonald moves the minutes. He's reviewed them carefully and has no changes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? We have the minutes approved. Dr. Parenti, please continue.
Thank you. It should be noted that this has been done with consensus across the country, mostly through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. I think, as many of you know, every state has an insurance commissioner that contributes to the overall regulation of the insurance industry. The items listed here in these bullets are the major components of what we're focused on. Premiums clearly are a major issue, but also the medical loss ratio, meaning how much money would be paid just for medical care and not for administrative burden. We'll talk more about what those ratios are, but the idea was to lock down a specific minimum ratio for that particular component. Other pieces that were discussed by this committee include how to reform the individual market, that is where people buy their coverage outside of an employer, looking at how to set up insurance exchanges, looking at how Medicare should be changed, looking about whether or not, as this state has discussed previously, interstate compacts so that we can have sale of insurance across state lines in isolated instances, looking at what data collection requirements are required by the federal government to have the health reform law proceed, also looking at fraud, and then a broader topic of cost containment. In 2011, the NAIC came up with a ruling proposing and was approved by HHS that there would be effective basically last month for the individual and small group market, a 28% of the medical loss ratio, 80% of medical loss ratio, meaning that 80% of what is collected in premium must go out for medical care in that space. Previously, that number could be as low as 60% for certain plans. For a large group, meaning a large employer, that number was pegged at 85%. This is actually quite a binding restriction. It's going to be probably taking months, if not more than a year, to figure out exactly what the impact of this piece of the provision is going to be. There also was components to come up with different activities to measure healthcare quality, though it's not exactly specified yet how that will transform. Most of the action for health reform occurs in 2014, and I'll show you a graph based on some CBO numbers looking at the expense to show you exactly how the dollars sort of match where the action occurs. By 2014, we'll have small group definitions increased to the size of 100. States can decide whether or not they reduce them down to 50 or not. Probably the big things that are going to be happening here, just summarizing some of these bills, is that premium will no longer be based on health status, that is how sick you are, and it will be prohibited to do this on the individual and small group level. This essentially is community rating in terms of the structure that's there. There might be some rating that goes on for geography and other components for different age pieces with no more than a ratio of 3 to 1. Just to give you some perspective on what that is, currently the standard is more like 7 to 1. If you go to 3 to 1, that means that potentially for someone who's age 55, will be able to have a premium, say, individually of about $8,000, but it could also mean that someone who is, say, 30 might actually have a premium that is maybe a little over $25,000 or $3,000, whereas before that might have just cost them $1,500. So it will be seen as a shift potentially to a younger population, most likely a benefit to an older population. Another thing is that pre-existing conditions must be excluded as a concern for basically covering people in the fully insured and self-insured plans, and that there can be no annual limits on these plans in terms of benefit payout. Now, another thing that happens as well, and I've included a little graphic of a building I just visited on Friday, This is in Bethesda, Maryland. It's by the Bethesda Metro stop across from the Hyatt. There is a new Office of Consumer Information Insurance Oversight. This was mandated to be created in 2010 with the following programs: an Office of Oversight for Insurance, an Office of Insurance Programs, an Office of Consumer Support, and an Office of Health Insurance Exchanges. This is, in effect, taking the state responsibility for being insurance commissioner provisions and putting it into federal hands. Right now, the two top floors of that building are occupied by this office, with expansion plans for other areas as well. This is established to implement private market reforms and to work with the CMS to ensure coordination between public and private market reforms. Effective by July of 2010 of last year, HHS with the states would basically create an internet portal to identify coverage options. This actually was done by a contract with eHealthInsurance.com. That was the most expedient way to do it through a private sector vendor rather than building it themselves. By 2010, HHS needed to develop what the format would be for including different premium options, MLR restrictions and availability. This was the big work that was done with NAIC. And then also by this point in time last year, the idea was to come, at least later into the year, I should say, there was the idea to put together different rules and information for HMOs to respond to, also through this Office of Insurance Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight. This office, actually known as OSIO now, at least by acronym names, is actually going to be moved outside of the DHS budget over to the Medicare and Medicaid budget because of the concern that the Republicans in the House will defund it. Exchange in 2014, this is probably where all the action really occurs in terms of the market and the major mechanisms. Essentially, by 2014, there will be exchanges put on the market. There are initial grants putting out for states to set these up. Minnesota is talking about taking $1 million to put that into place. The idea is that in terms of standards, as soon as practical, HHS will set standards for plan certification, marketing, network adequacy, and plan rating, setting up navigators and risk sharing. States to create electronic interchange for eligibility of Medicaid and subsidies will also go through the exchanges as well, meaning that Medicaid programs can be operating through the exchanges. Funding would be up to $2 billion to states for exchange startup. In terms of structure, the states may create a separate or combined exchange for individual and small group markets. They can start that now, actually in the end of 2010. Regional and subsidiary exchanges for distinct state geographies are also allowed. For eligibility, individuals not eligible for affordable employer coverage in small groups, states may allow large groups to come in 2017. For outside markets, folks of the exchange, they can do that, but they still have to comply to the national rules that are there, and they would not be eligible for any of the subsidies that are available from the expansion of coverage that have been proposed in the legislation. Those are the major changes. Another major change in order to try to bend the cost curve down is to have payment reform and care coordination. We now have a new CMS administrator, Dr. Donald Berwick. He created the Center for Innovation Center. It actually has already been created prior to at the end of 2010 to test and expand Medicare payment models and expand other components down. There will be different demonstrations that are involved in these. A Medicaid global payment system has been considered. The medical home, very similar to what Minnesota has been talking about for a while, is also for demonstration. A Medicaid bundled payment demonstration coming by 2012. Some way to pay physicians differently for value-based purchasing by 2011, other bundled payment components, and then maybe a bundled payment pilot by 2013 out of Medicare. As a editorial comment, this is, I guess, maybe this is humor, maybe not. My concern is that in having some of these demonstrations roll forward, there is a lot of shadow play that's going on and not very honest conversations beyond the first two or three bullets. One of the biggest concerns that providers have voiced to me privately and publicly as far as testimony is that they hate the fee-for-service system. They feel that they're on a conveyor. They feel that they're working on a factory floor and they're just paying for basically doing the services. The thought is the insurers need to do that. This sort of gives an illustration of a dynamic discussion where the insurers might respond, how would we actually pay you for performing? To which they could come back and say, well, we're going to, as providers, then use electronic medical records, use accountable care organizations, use medical homes, and then you will pay us with that type of information, to which the insurers respond, that's great, why don't you do that, but also make sure you give us that fee-for-service claims data at the same time. One editorial note, when I was testifying from the Senate about something similar to this, at an identical time when Don Berwick was presenting, someone at CMS to this question said, we will never give up taking the fee-for-service claims data. right as Don Berwick said, this Innovation Center will be transformative. I'll give you the link if you want to see it, that side-by-side play, minute-by-minute in the Senate. And so the provider's response is, of course, what are you kidding me? This is more work and you will pay us less. The insurer's response, and granted it's rather cavalier, but honest perhaps, guess so, you always have the other way, which is cash practices. And you see how this is going. Basically, you go back and forth in the sense that fee-for-service still remains the most efficient way to pay providers in lieu of actually having a different system in place that's easier than fee-for-service. For Medicaid reform, this is essentially Minnesota's new path now with Governor Dayton's proposal. The idea is we have the option to take early Medicaid adoption of the program as proposed by the federal government. We can take in childless adults. We can look at under 65 folks. We can go to up to 133% of the federal poverty line. The option is available until 2014, at which point it is mandatory for this Medicaid expansion to be operating. We cannot actually convert an existing program, so this is one reason why MinnesotaCare and other things become sort of at issue, and it does create a new Medicaid category to be developed. Now, in terms of what the national impact of all this together, and I must say at the end of my slides there's more detail about the law. It's hard to summarize 2,700 pages in 10 slides, but this is the highlights in terms of coverage determination and major regulatory impact. When we look at the actual estimates in terms of costs, in terms of uninsured reductions, we're basically talking about a 60% reduction of the uninsured or 81% of the base is U.S. citizens only to newly covered folks, basically 30.7 million people. CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, estimates that this will have a 10-year cost of $940 billion with a savings of $130 billion. Right before that period of time, I, working with some other economists, came up with a number that said it was going to be closer to $1.36 trillion. Most of what we assume is that the benefits are more generous than perhaps when people were assuming in CBO. What you need to know for Congressional Budget Office, which I think you probably know, is that whatever the assumptions are for plan design that a congressman or senator hands you, whether you think they are a great idea or not, you must use. This is different than going to an actuary and saying, score this as best you can based on your professional reputation. That is the one tweak to it. If you come in with an assumption and say that all of the private plans will be based on Medicaid cost expenditures, which is 30 to 40% less than private plans, the CBO must make that calculation that way. And that is what they did to get that number at that time. Summary, additional costs will eliminate a deficit savings and actually reduce a reduction. I said that it would actually increase costs. Now, what's interesting is that there's another way to look at this, too, this time using CBO's own numbers. If we go year by year and we look at expenditures, right now we're really not spending very much money on this at all. If anything, money is going towards setting up some of the exchanges, some of the other provisions, setting up the office space for OSIO in Bethesda, Maryland. By 2014 is when the dollars really start to roll for this. When we look at the actual dollars that come in, there are initial revenue enhancements or things that are coming in immediately. Now, some of them actually are no longer valid. Probably the biggest component of what you see here on the top, that blue line, is reductions and annual updates to the Medicare fee-for-service payment rates, otherwise known as the physician doc fix. That has already been put on hold as part of the extension of the Bush tax credits, so that is in effect offline for the moment. What does this mean in terms of if you go by those two numbers? We see that there's an initial uptick in the budget, but deficit, but actually it does save money for a while until it comes fully into effect by 2016, then it's costing money, and then the expectation is the Cadillac tax will save ever more money as time goes on. Now, the concern is that there are different pieces that have been coming in after the fact, or probably to be renegotiated, that cut bolted onto the general reform idea. One of them is the CLASS Act, which is a voluntary long-term care insurance policy, which is one way that seemed to address with long-term care Medicaid costs as the baby boomers age. Another one is additional excise taxes that were not factored in that might also be crept in. The other thing is the doc fix, as mentioned before, and this big one in blue, market basket update, basically means taking the Medicaid fee schedule to physicians and moving it to Medicare rates, which basically means paying physicians instead of 40 cents on the dollar for normal commercial rates, they're closer to 80 cents on the dollar going forward. If you're a physician, that's good. If you're running a deficit, you're going to add to it. And so when you put all those pieces together, you actually end up with a situation where you're now adding to the deficit substantially and no longer in a position, even using CBO's own numbers, that you are actually cost-saving. Sort of tongue-in-cheek, this is actually, I'm a bit of a rail fan from time to time. I grew up in the East Coast. This is Union Station, and this is a GG1 electric locomotive where its brakes went out in 1950. If anyone's been to Union Station and you ate in the food court, it landed on the food court and crushed it. Okay, but this took a little while to fix. It may take 2 to 4 years if you think of this as actually a fiscal concern to actually get it to articulate the right way. And I do think it can be changed, but it's going to be expensive, even based on the CBO's numbers as going forward. So other concerns to keep in mind in terms of national estimates and what's going on with the uninsured. If we go by the different options that people have talked about, and if you go by the list of Senate, it's probably the easiest way to look at, which is what ultimately got passed. We look at, say, by 2013, 2014, or 2013 in particular, up to nearly 56 million people will be uninsured by that point before the bill actually comes into line. And this is actually assuming that we were going to probably have 8% unemployment by the end of 2010, which we don't have, which means this number will probably get worse than that and be closer, most likely, to 56 or 57 million people. The CMS actuary actually backs this number up as well. Now, the good news is that by 2019, we will have a substantial reduction in the uninsured, but we will also see a substantial increase in premiums. Another set of numbers looking at here is just saying, what does it cost today if someone were to buy a family premium covering a spouse and, say, several children in the open market, as it were, and then how do those prices change at year-over-year inflation of 8%? It might be also noted that the year-over-year 8% number is what CBO did use for many of their calculations. So the gold plan, which is sort of the moderate plan, or somewhere between silver and gold, Cloak, Garrison, Keillor, just slightly above average, perhaps, that would pretty much fall in about $13,000 per year for a 2010 premium. You take that out to somewhere between 2019, we're talking nearly a doubling of that. Is that actually realistic? Probably, because in 2000, premiums for families was $5,000. This stuff can happen and actually has been happening consistently, that the dollar amounts are getting much worse than before, given that actually our economic growth at best is going to be 2 to 3% throughout the rest of this coming decade. So the expenses get pretty high quickly. And you can see for the premium and gold plans, otherwise known as the Cadillac plans, it's a substantial bump up in terms of cost of nearly $38,000 as your premium in 2019. So what impact will this have for Minnesotans? Basically, there's going to be decisions in terms of what to do for the lifetime benefits. If people have already decided what to do with this. And for the most part, they're basically buying up and paying more in premiums. They might shift in more with their labor resources to cover some of the things that have already happened in 2010, 2011. The one thing that's going to change quite a bit when we get to 2013 and 2014, and this becomes more real, is that basically the IRS will have to work much more closely with all large employers at a level no one has ever seen before. Right now, most large employers send a tape. It goes in. Now the tape has to get verified, come back, and actually be more of an electronic real exchange to really see what someone's wages are, to figure out whether they qualify for subsidy, whether this is credible coverage. And that's just in the employer market. In the individual market, the reason why the bill actually added an extra 700 pages is that it had to basically rewrite IRS code and Department of Treasury code to get access to a data feed from Treasury in real time to score people for their eligibility based on their income, based on their prior returns, and based on their estimated payments. That's why this is one of the more sweeping pieces of legislation that has ever hit before. So, what other things to keep in mind? Consumer-driven health plans, an area I've done a lot of research in there. I can see they have value. Sometimes they don't. If you ever were having a conversation in a Parenti household, you'd hear a very active debate going on between my wife and I about the virtues of these plans, giving the deductibles. I think at one point there was someone that hung up on one or the other when we chose the plan initially. But we stick with them and we see what they're doing. So I'm taking my poison here. But about these things, they do save money, as I said from the very beginning. I mean, actuarially, they work. What's interesting is whether or not we're going to see an expansion in the Medicaid side for these plans. Not because we think it's a great thing to do in terms of care, but because as a nation, it's all we can afford. And if that occurs, that the upside is that people get to go whatever provider they want to go to, but there's going to have to be some way to sort of buttress those costs going downstream in that particular design. And that's what these things provide. For different benefit card technologies and voucher systems, you can effectively voucherize Medicaid, which is something that the Republicans have been after in terms of state block grants for a while, and some fiscal conservatives, even on the Democrat side, think that's not a bad idea either. So if Minnesota wants to lead, where are the opportunities? Most of the bill, interestingly enough, came from a woman that I worked with in the 1990s, who was George Herbert Walker Bush CMS administrator. Her name is Gail Walensky, Dr. Gail Walensky, an economist who was working at Project Hope when I was there. At the time, she was the senior domestic policy advisor to George Bush. Most of the bill that has been passed, with the exception of the individual mandate, was what was called at the time pay or play. When Bill Clinton was elected president, most of that law is discussed inside the Senate. At the time I worked at the U.S. Senate, working for Jay Rockefeller, was thrown away, basically to move with what the Clintons were proposing as health policy. Ironically, many of the pieces came back, except with other things that were buttressed onto it. This is a long way of saying the idea of an insurance exchange has been around for a while and actually came from moderate Republicans in terms of how these things are structured. The concern, though, is the way this thing is written in the statute. Not so much actually what the HHS secretary will determine somewhere as to be determined, but actually in the statute requires data feeds and verification from Homeland Security, the Justice Department, IRS, immigration, and the insurance industry as well, along with, if the providers want to get into this for real, their accountable care organization components, all coming in. There's not a precedent for this. And it's actually to the point where, as we know, it actually came out recently that maybe we'll take $1 million to look for an exchange. I can tell you from a candid conversation talking to Osayo last Friday, the expectation is the feds will build the template and the states will take it, because it's just too difficult to get all these data feeds together. And it's basically going to route through the feds with essentially a state portal label associated with it, with some details to be worked out. Now, where can Minnesota do? We got 4 years, or really three. We can build it ourselves. Now, how unrealistic is that? Let me throw you a little illustration, a little bit of a curveball to show that Minnesota can be quite innovative in this space and already has been, not in the healthcare industry, but in the financial services industry. So, a few things you can do. You can revisit the existing Minnesota reform legislation passed in 2008. You can take dollars that are already committed to basically taking a data feed that's going to the state of Maine and bring it back here. You can use that information to basically commission out 4 real-time data bureaus of insurance and limited clinical data, because you're going to need it for underwriting. I know that there are people that are on the Republican side that will not like this at all. You can always opt out. If you don't want your data to be used, that's fine. What that means is, if you don't want your data to be used for underwriting, what most insurers and actuaries do at that point is, we give you the top price, you now pay the opportunity cost for your privacy, and we're all good. Your privacy is preserved, but you pay a higher premium. If we don't want to have that frank a conversation, we should be. We can use the financial services success for 4 of these bureaus already in place. We live today with every purchase we make at Best Buy and Target with 4 credit bureaus constantly monitoring our data in identical data formats in real time. Anytime we go to Best Buy to buy a large screen TV, or even Target to buy diapers, someone, when you swipe your credit card, goes across these 4 databases and says, are you in debt? Where's your credit load? Where's your bank account? Are you in the right zip code in real time before they say, yeah, let's have that transaction move? Because the dollars are technically floated for 1 day before it clears that particular transaction. Technically, this can be built. Health insurance data basically is 4 decades old. It's operating off a Ross-Perot EDS model built basically in 1968 and hasn't advanced much beyond that structure since it can. And here's an opportunity where we could. There's a new Medicare fraud piece of legislation that came out as part of the Small Bill Jobs Act that basically advocates for near real-time assessment of Medicare claims data in 10 states by 2011, July 2011, and 20 states by 2012. I'll show you a map that'll show that Minnesota is likely to be one of those states. We have fraud in this state. So you can use the bureau data to create these real-time insurance marts using the infrastructure that Medicare is effectively going to pay for with the vendors that it will probably award in the next few months. And this will allow you to embrace, if you will, 21st century technology for this type of knowledge. What more specifics about the financial services industry? One right in our midst in Minneapolis, Fair Isaac Corporation, otherwise known as FICO. They built this model. They've leveraged it out across 4 other credit bureaus, meaning Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, all scoring this information in real time. They started 25 years ago. The Back to the Future reference there for those that are movie buffs, with a little DeLorean there. Basically, they did it because electronic card transfers for credit cards basically created an entire fraud opportunity that was out of control. That created an incentive for the banks to actually open up their portals to share their information, to collaborate, to find the fraud. Did the federal government pay for them to do that? No. Did they have it in self-interest to do it? Yes. Right now, we are bribing all the provider community roughly $34 billion from the stimulus bill to share data for the sake of their patients' own health that they otherwise should be sharing but refuse to because of a lame excuse that the data systems won't connect, even though in the state of Minnesota, in the metro area, they all use the Epic platform. It's just a phone call away to the Epic CEO in Wisconsin, a friendly state, to say link the data together as a prototype, and yet we don't do it. The financial services model shows that you can do it if you have the courage to link your information, and we can't actually say that data technology is so old today compared to what was 25 years ago available. This will take care of the data siloing and create the repositories needed. If you have that information, not only can you actually create an insurance exchange, you could stop fraud. Minnesota probably has some of the worst fraud in the home health agency service claims that the country has actually seen. We're not as bad as Illinois, but we're not necessarily stellar either. If we actually score our fraud and create, people know the Dartmouth Atlas of Health Services Utilization. This is a recent report I've been working on with various colleagues from an HHS grant looking at scoring fraud for predictive models. We score high, actually, along with Florida, Texas, and a few other states around the country. And so if we potentially have an opportunity to get in on this business and actually reuse the technology that's already going to be paid for, in effect, for creating an exchange market. So what if you did this? You could actually take the four data bureau information and create actuarially certified risk profiles. What's the value of this? If we create a portal or contract out someone else to build a portal for us, that means we can shop in our pajamas to buy insurance and actually have our pre-existing data go into it, lock us down to premium, and on a click, actually get that information. And what if you don't have the money to? You'll know what subsidy is available to you on track. It'll insert the voucher. That'll show your lower premium, and you're done. And Medicaid could run the same way as a structure. This is entirely buildable because it was built 20 years ago in the financial services industry. You can have also this be used as a way to figure out when people are in need, meaning point three, where the market fails. That's when you go to the high-risk insurance market. That's when you use MCHA to basically be rebuilt. MCHA was built in 1978. Lots changed since 1978. We can reuse the technology to get better risk scores to make it work a little bit better, and don't mess with the employer-sponsored market. It's fine. So this is just a way of saying, in more detail, and I won't go into this one, how you could use the existing technology that's available and do one step further that actually might get you the electronic medical records. Right now, physicians in Medicare are paid faster than by commercial payers across the country. There are prompt pay laws for Medicare that says that physicians need to be paid within 30 days. Right now, on average, a commercial payer takes approximately 60 days to pay someone. I don't know how many of you have independent vendors, but if you're waiting on average 60 days to get paid, you're probably not happy for it. Now, the question is, can you move that quicker? If you incent the providers and say, you know you have blood pressure and weight, and we're going to ask it for you from a year from now to actually do our quality profiles for ICSI or whatever organization you're talking about, what if you give it to us now, and in return, we'll pay you in 2 days? That will actually reduce a substantial cost in terms of transmission of information and actually make the information available for underwriting to let other people get their premiums down if they're taking care of themselves. Okay. So, pragmatic solutions you can go through. Create these financial services hubs, use predictive technology, create a FICO score, use that information in exchange that can be built today. And your goal is going to be to try to incent the medical providers at the same time to bend the cost curve down by showing what their data actually is, pay them less, try to prevent some fraud on the fly before you pay it, because the way fraud works today, if you're listening to even Catherine Sebelius or Don Berwick, is that they're estimating Medicare fraud is approximately $60 to $70 billion per year. That's a huge number. Our estimates are closer to more like $35 or $40 billion per year. The recoverable part of that to date is at best $3 or $4 billion, and actually if you dig into that number, you see at least four federal agencies double counting the numbers. And the reason why it's so hard is that you have to do chase and recover. You have to prove a case, you got to take it to, you have to find the person. Many of these folks that are really doing this as a business get out of it as soon as the first ping occurs. What the credit card industry did was as soon as something looked awkward, they stopped the payment. before there was ever a chance of actually having the person run away with it. And then the thought is if the vendor really complained, then they would actually do something about it. But when they first implemented this technology in the 1990s, 40% of the vendors disappeared when they shut off the claims volume. That's an awful lot of fraud to find that you otherwise didn't think was actually there. And that's about the same moment we are in the medical care industry. So it gives you a two-for-one. You get to have this data portal coming in, as well as actually save, considering our Medicaid budgets, a considerable amount of money if it works the right way. So some closing thoughts. Minnesota has a proud tradition in health system innovation. I teach a medical industry MBA program at the Carlson School of Management. We have about 100 students now taking a whole set of courses over there, working throughout the provider industry, the technology industry, and the insurance industry. The Mayo Clinic, Medtronic, even United Health Group, we point to all these things as being national models in each of their own domain space. It's time to be a leader again. It's going to take, however, a real public-private partnership, meaning that if there are for-profit firms in this state that otherwise we may not have an appetite to talk to seriously, we might want to talk to them. Fair Isaac's just down the road. United Health Group has a giant poster campaign all around Washington, D.C., saying 73,000 employees taking care of 70 million covered lives, which, of course, is a strange ratio to have, 1 in 1,000, because the primary care ratio in the country is actually worse than that, but we'll just let that go. But that said, there really are opportunities to work with a lot of very good global brands to kind of make this thing be an export economy for this state, as it's been. Health maintenance organization, our idea. Huge group practices across the country, Mayo is ground zero. The MA in the 1930s went to war against the Mayo Clinic because they were so upset with what the Mayo Clinic was doing and reducing the dues payment to the American Medical Association. Time is short to act. Right now, our inertia will threaten the state's medical innovation track record as well as its sovereignty. That is the budget-busting component that we're all facing. Every state, but Minnesota is obviously not immune. The feds privately assume states cannot build exchanges because of the data links required for IRS and Homeland, et cetera. We're talking about $1 million. What's $1 million going to do? I can already tell you that there's at least three or four vendors that are kind of like me, except with mercenary hats going, ooh, cool, we're going to get $400,000 of that to score that. For people that otherwise are going to make $250,000 a year as their pay package on a W-2, you think that's going to build an exchange? You need to build it yourself. We need to roll up our sleeves. You need to talk to these for-profit firms and say, build this with us in partnership as a loss leader, and we'll sell it to the country. That's a way to be innovative. The feds also don't know what they don't know, meaning they don't know how the financial services industry built. How do I know that? Many of the people in that office in Bethesda, they're friends, okay? But they don't talk to industry. They've been doing health service research and public health and going from government agency and contract and writing really good specs for a long time and watching the winter storms come and go in the snow. They don't know how to build this stuff unless they've been directly tied with major corporations, which has not necessarily played into the healthcare space. So some tactical closing thoughts. Things you can do. March 2011, do what CMS does. Have an industry day. Meet these firms that have previously been shunned for this type of operation. April 2011, invite white papers from these firms for free. Don't pay them. Just say, what can you think of that could actually work in a partnership arrangement? May 2011, create a short-term system innovation commission. Short-term meaning it's done by 2012. To recommend changes for immediate consideration and votes to start at the next session, because we know we can't get it done this session. Actually see what can be built. And then in 2012, if it looks good enough, build it. Redirect the funds. The dollars are already committed. You don't have to necessarily go with five-year option contracts of what's already been proposed. In 2013, if it's working, well before the exchanges are coming online, export it. By 2014, if it's working really well, if we've gotten essentially our uninsured level, officially go to essentially whatever agency is available in 2014 and say, leave us be. We figured this out, and we're willing to share what we've learned, just as Minnesota has done for 80 years. And with that, I welcome your questions.
Dr. Parente, thank you for your presentation. Members, our goal here is we've got two presentations. I want to leave plenty of time for questions. A few people had already raised their hands. Your names are on the list. I think we're gonna take a few of those right now for Dr. Parente. Move to the next presentation, and then again try to leave plenty of time for us to ask lots of questions. I see Representative Hundley's got a whole pile of paper he wants to hand out yet, so I'm sure he's got some things to say. And really, I mean. there are some great ideas here being thrown out. Nobody's saying whether which one's right or wrong yet. That's going to be up to us. But as we talk about reform, we need to be opening our minds to the realities. And I heard there things that were for and against what's happening in Washington and for and against things that are happening in Minnesota. And I appreciate the new approach to thinking about this. With that, I've got Representative Quam, Representative Moran, Representative Franson, Representative Murphy, and Representative Huntley in that order. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need a little information. You had gone over early on the, you know, there's hundreds of millions of dollars coming from the Cadillac. But also, I believe I've seen quite a few exemptions to groups in the Cadillac from unions and major donors to, or major corporations, I should say. So what is the quantified level of the existing exemptions as compared to the calculated CBO amount?
That's a very good question. The let me see if I can have it in the figure that's here. The
Dr. Parente.
Thank you. Representative Quam, the... if we look at, say, this line in green that's here, the excise tax and other realities, that essentially is estimating what happens if we put back the deals that were essentially being cut after the fact back into the system that's there. Some of it is actually mixed in a little bit with some of the other components in this tax and save pieces that are there, but most of it tends to fall into particular that area. And you raise a very valid point. You know, some of those deals are basically in place, and they come online in 2016 and 2017. They actually can hurt people. And here we actually try to see what capture you're going to have back in. And one of the concerns about any one of these things is that it's clearly going to be additive to the cost and how many deals will these things be extended. For example, the dock fix that was proposed in 1997 in the Balanced Budget Act, that can has been kicked down the road well over a decade, and that's the big fear that some of these things might, when they come back up again, say for the labor unions getting a break on some of the excise tax, once again it gets kicked down, where will that actually end? So it's a pretty real concern.
Thank you. Representative Moran.
I'm going to, I just really wanted him to slow down a little bit. This is a lot to take in. He was going really fast. So I'm going to just pass.
And Representative Moran, I apologize because we have so much data to get out. And I hope we'll have some other opportunities to continue to discuss this. This was a big package. It has a lot of impacts and a lot of possibilities, and I realized we had to move through it kind of quickly, and we'll have to do the same with the other. I wish we had, you know, maybe a couple of days to go over this, but thank you for that.
It's really, really important, and yeah, there are some benefits.
Thank you. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Parente, regarding the IRS, correct me if I'm wrong here, but okay, so a business will know exactly how much your entire household makes, correct? Because they'd be able to see your W-2s and...
What the business might have to do, Representative France, what the business might have to be able to do is at least participate in an exchange that's going to be having some of that information that's on tap to figure out to what extent you're going to qualify for a subsidy or otherwise in that place. So, for example, today, a business will go to the IRS website to submit ultimately what will go into a W-3 form. This might go one step further. Interesting. I'm just thinking about this out loud, where once you're basically dropping in the Social Security numbers of who's actually working there, additional information is now piping back from IRS, perhaps from Social Security, that essentially makes some adjustments on the fly, at least as you're reporting your taxes and trying to figure out where pieces will settle out.
Representative Franson.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Parente, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, too. So let's say that the employer then knows exactly what your household income is to determine whether or not that employee would qualify for a subsidy or...
Well,
regular insurance, correct?
Yeah. Let's be clear. If it's a small employer, they're most likely going to be operating through an exchange mechanism, and there's going to be some credits that are available to that small employer. The question is whether or not they're coming directly to the small employer, mm-hmm. or whether they get, most likely they will be targeted that way rather than going specifically to that individual. Now, just to be clear, if it's a large employer, and they're not getting a tax credit because they're large. If the individual leaves that employer's coverage, then that employer is subject to a fine for having that person left. And then there's also the issue if the person happens to be leaving and the coverage itself was subpar compared to what the feds think it's going to be, there's an additional fine that's associated with that as well. The only way the feds can do that is to have the ability to do a head count, employee by employee, of who stays in and who walks from that large firm.
Representative Francis.
One more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Prente, could this model encourage businesses to hire those that would qualify for just subsidies?
Dr. Prente.
Not likely, because the only way that could occur is if the employer hires them not as W-2 employees but as contractors, at which point they are not part of the employed workforce. Could do that. We've seen that happen in prior economies, right? But otherwise, if they do get the subsidy, that likely means that they are getting it through the exchange, and if they have gone into the exchange, the employer will face a fine.
Thank you. I just want to remind members, we probably have about 5-10 minutes here before we need to get to our next presenter, but I've got Representative Murphy, Representative Huntley, Representative Grinhagen, and Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question to you. Is this, do you think, the one day that we're going to be talking about this issue? Because I know there were some folks that were hoping to participate in the discussion, and they weren't able to do so today. Or do you think this is a discussion we'll have in the future?
Representative Murphy, I would expect that we'll be talking about the ACA quite a bit throughout the course of this entire committee. Today was meant to be some idea starter, reform-minded presentations to the committee. I do understand some people asked to testify, which we typically do during a formal hearing, usually on a proposal or when we have some sort of invitation for different sides. I really didn't want to turn this into their team shows up and presents their perspective and the other team shows up and presents their perspective. And we may have an opportunity to do that. And I suspect as specific proposals come before this committee, we will in fact have some of that happening. But wanting to get some academics, if you will, to kind of give us some ideas and some starting points. So that's not happening today, but I think that opportunity will exist in the future for the committee. And there was no intent to really quell that. It's just this is a different purpose today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then for Dr. Parente, nice to see
you. Yes, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a comment that you made about midway through, and I took notes. I wrote fast because you were speaking quickly. But I think you said something. You were talking about the high deductible plans and said something about this is not necessarily something we would wish for care, but it's because we need to pursue it because it's what we can afford as a nation,
yes.
Right? And that caught me, right? Because we're talking today about Medicaid and public programs, and we know that the people in those public programs have a higher rate of disease, et cetera. So I want to respectfully disagree and just say I want more. I want a higher goal for us, right? I want affordable care, but that is care that is meaningful for the people that are receiving it, and I'm pretty sure you want that too. And then in your closing thoughts, you said it's time to be a leader again, and again, I just want to respectfully disagree because I think Minnesota has continued to be a leader. In my short tenure in the legislature, we have been doing a lot of work bipartisanly on reform. I'm sure Representative Huntley is going to talk about that a little bit. But as we proceed, and this, you know, echoes what Representative Gottwald was saying, we have different perspectives on how to approach reforming the healthcare delivery system. Some of that's partisan, and some of that is from where we come. You know, I'm a healthcare provider, so I look at the system from our perspective, and you look at it from a different perspective, and I think we have to remember to use the word and not or. That if and we look at what I'm thinking about and what you're thinking about and what others are thinking about, we might be able to actually move reforms forward that are going to deal with the costs, which is what we're interested in doing, and provide the care that we need to in a dignified way, which I think we also all agree that we want to do. So I just want to ring the bell for Minnesota to remind us that we have a tradition of leading. I think much of what is in the Affordable Care Act looks a lot like what we've already been working on Minnesota, and we need to keep moving forward. I agree with your bullet that it's the time is now. We have to act now. I agree with that part. Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Parente, I'm just trying to keep up with where you were. You talked about keeping our high-risk pool, if I got it right, but I thought if we had no pre-existing conditions, which is what the ACA does, why would you need a high-risk pool?
Dr. Parente.
Representative Huntley, it's an interim measure to keep the high-risk pool until 2014. And so then after that, you would not have a need for it anymore, and you would essentially, at least that's the expectation, that you wouldn't have to have it anymore.
Okay, and Mr.
Representative
Chairman
Huntley.
And Dr. Parente, I was interested in your comments about the accountable care organizations and maintaining the fee-for-service instead of going to a total cost of care model. Could you comment on that?
Dr. Parente.
My concern about the accountable care organizations is that it's very noble in its intention, but there's no prototype that has demonstrated that it will actually function as billed. People are talking about demonstrations to make it actually operate. So that's one concern, just looking at it as, other than looking at, say, HMOs of, say, the vintage of the 1970s, that many of them didn't survive, actually. The other concern that I have is the intentions of the provider community by wanting to have an accountable care organization. That is, there's always been a nascent war going on between the provider community and the insurance industry, just to be honest here, I guess what tenure affords. And when I hear comments, at least privately uttered, going back and forth to D.C. on a plane or in a Delta Sky Club about our goal as providers is to disintermediate the payer and sell directly to the employer, the question comes to me is, tell me when you've done that before and how successful has it been? So that's when I get concerned.
And
Representative Huntley.
Dr. Parente, and members, I do have, and I'm going to hand out later the Governor Pawlenty's Transformation Task Force report on healthcare from 2008, plus a map that shows where the high quality states are and where the low quality states are. And I agree with Dr. Parente that Minnesota is very good. But what does your high deductible proposal do for, since we spend about 75% of the healthcare dollar and people have chronic illnesses, so they're already sick, how does a high deductible health plan help us manage people with chronic illnesses?
Dr. Parente.
The research that I've done looking at folks with chronic conditions that are in the insured population that are having high deductible health plans suggests that they are not being hurt by that design. The only people that are really being hurt, in my view, by the plan design where we have too generous coverage of design is that people can't afford the premiums and they'll go completely uninsured and are potentially at risk of bankruptcy because they don't even have a negotiated payment that they can fall back on when a provider says the charges are this, when actually the negotiated rate might be 10% of that particular rate. So, as I said, I'm not entirely wedded and loving the notion of the high deductible health plan. It is a bit of a tough love component. To answer your question more specifically, if there are populations that are in fiscal need because they actually need to have their costs covered, there could be a separate pool set up for that and designed to address that on a an after-the-fact needs-based plan. That's one proposal that different economists in Minnesota have proposed for several years, that after we know the costs and we come in and basically patch up those costs after the fact. The other reality is that for many people in the state, they get the care and then the care is billed. As I mentioned, because of that billing cycle, it could be a 60-day delay on average in the commercial insurance payment system, and for several providers here, the delay could be as much as 120 days after the care has been rendered. That's plenty of time to reconcile who should pay from what purse, what level of need for folks that are falling inside that high deductible threshold.
I might also mention, Representative Huntley and members, there was a bill, House File 1865, a while ago that dealt with a high deductible for low-income people in that very same way, where the state actually dealt with the deductible portion from an affordability perspective. So the model itself is not the problem. It's how you deal with the deductible. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, Dr. Parente, I certainly do agree with you about Minnesota having a number of organizations that could help us do the electronic and get those payments much sooner. We have lots of good firms that know how to do that, and I have several in mind, and hope they. I do like your idea of getting a white paper out there, and I particularly like your idea about getting a task force ready to go on this, and that's why we put it in last year's bill. And if the current governor wishes to set up a task force, we have $198,000 sitting there with the previous governor refused to spend.
Okay, we have two more representatives, and like I said, we'll have time after the next presentation yet too, so this isn't your last call. But Representative Grinhagen and then Representative Kiffmeyer, maybe one question apiece if we can.
Sure. How about two quick ones, Ms. Chair?
Representative Grinhagen, I'll accept that negotiated settlement.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Representative Grinhagen.
Dr. Parente, just a couple questions. On the one sheet you have here, you say effective January 2011, 80% MLR payout for individual and 85% for large groups. The 80% also applies to small groups. What's the payout for Medicaid and Medicare right now? My understanding is Medicare is about 60-some percent, Medicaid's about 40-some percent. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on which
Dr.
number.
Parente.
It depends, Representative Griffin, on where you fall. Medicare might claim that their number is more likely to be something like 96, 95% in terms of where the spend is. Medicaid, I'm not quite sure on that number. My guess is it can't be that much. It can't be much above 90 in terms of the spend, depending upon how the states contract, what they're doing, and what administrative loading they have associated with it. Now, keep in mind, the when we talk about what's inside that administrative expense, that goes for the insurance company, the administration of the claim, mm-hmm. the profits, if there are profits and or surplus, and a major component of it is the broker fees. That also gets factored in there as well. And that's probably, of all the things, the most radical change that could occur to this market, which is to the extent that the exchanges become electronic portals, as has happened in Massachusetts with their connector, the brokers might very well be completely disintermediated from the process if the direct purchase components are there. If you're a broker, you may not like this.
I think it's the word eliminate, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Representative
okay.
Grinhagen.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. If I'm going to be eliminated, I just soon know that. But anyway, the other quick question is we.
Representative Grinhagen.
Yeah, Ms. Chair, Dr. Parente. Why have we seen such dramatic premium increases since the passage of Obamacare? I have my own opinion, but I'd be interested to hear what yours are in the private and group market.
Well, in the case of both of them, keep in mind that the rule did change and say that you're going to now add additional costs. So rescission probably did not add very much actuarially to what's going on. In the case of the slacker tax, that did. Mostly because, just because if you're an actuary, you're kind of cold with this type of thing. If your age is between, say, 21 and 26, which is the new range that you're there, and you're a male, that's not that expensive. Statistically, it's one-third of a woman's reproductive cycle, and that adds a lot of cost. It's not to be too crass about it, but when policies like that were extended in the state of California to be really, really ultra-low catastrophic plans, the price for men in California was $100 per month, and for women it was $300 per month, purely off of the probability, not certainty, of pregnancy. So that's one thing that got factored into the expression that wasn't previously in play. That probably was one of the largest components was there, plus some of the uncertainty of worrying about what the lifetime max might be, and that could probably stretch back.
Mr. Chair, just conclusion, premiums are higher. We're going to have
more. Representative Grinhagen.
Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer, real short.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Parente, on the Medicaid reform, Minnesota's new path, the early Medicaid adoption, then it has a line down here that says, converting an existing program, not an option, and new Medicaid category required. Had you covered this in more detail earlier and I just missed it? I know you went pretty quickly, but could you repeat it if you haven't said so before or add it?
My
Sorry, Dr. Parente.
Representative Kiffmeyer, my understanding of this is, and I'm not the perfect expert on this one, but my understanding is that for the states like Minnesota that have come up with their own way of dealing with folks on public assistance, if you're going to be accepting federal dollars for public assistance, you can't just channel it into your existing program. You have to consider a different design that basically is a forerunner, an early adoption of what would be in place come 2014. And so that's where the intention is, because the concern is that the expectation from a fiscal concern is that they didn't want to make it just be a cash transfer. They wanted to actually have it be, in a sense, a planning grant and basically a starter grant for a more expansive system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, and Dr. Parente, I appreciate your coming today and giving us a lot of your perspective, a lot of information. I just want to say this term, slacker tax, I hope we can get rid of that term. I just think it's very insulting. And I'm not even sure what you're referring to. I think you're talking about the expansion to age 26.
Yes.
I don't know why you're calling that a slacker tax, but I have to say that a lot of those folks are folks who are employed and who get employed in jobs where they don't get insurance. And, you know, they're not slackers. I mean, maybe some of them are, but I just hope that we can get away from the insulting term, because it really sort of spoils a lot of the good things that you've said. And, you know, just it really threw me off. I just want to say that. But thank you for your testimony today.
Dr. Parente, thank you for your testimony before the committee, and we may have you back. I think these were some very interesting ideas and perspectives that we haven't heard yet. Next, I want to welcome Peter Nelson from the Center for the American Experiment to the testifying table. And members, what we'll do is we'll line up questions and do much like we did with Dr. Parente, just so that we can keep the presentation moving forward and wrap this up by the time we're supposed to close. Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and title for the record.
Hold on one moment. Let me get my presentation up here. We have the wrong presentation. I'm not Doug Wood.
Members, I might take this moment to mention we do have bills in the possession of the committee. We are arranging hearings, so this we are going to continue to hear bills as they come forward. And but I think these presentations, again, are good opportunities for us to think maybe a bit outside the box and with some information from some knowledgeable people to help us along the way. Mr. Nelson, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, great. If you can state your name for the record and then proceed with the presentation. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Peter Nelson. I'm a policy analyst with Center of the American Experiment, Minnesota-focused Public Policy Institute, and I've been working with healthcare policy for about the past 4 or 5 years and focusing really on what we are all doing here at the state level. And my purpose here today is to give you a presentation on what the ACA will actually mean to Minnesota, and focusing more on what we've been doing over the past couple of years in Minnesota and where we can possibly be moving forward with the ACA. To start, I'm going to give an introduction and just talk a little bit about the federal role, because I think it's really important to have a conversation here at the state level about what the federal role is in all of this and what the state role is. And once I'm done with that, I will move on to sort of the meat of what's going on here with the ACA and talk about impacts on Medicaid, impacts on the insurance market, impacts on employers, and impacts on the state budget. So again, as we get into this issue, we really have to, I think, take a step back and really think about the federal role and the state role.
and understand that the ACA is really represents a very dramatic shift in the federal role as it regards our health insurance and our health care. The ACA, in that process of expanding the federal role, it's really diminishing the state's role. The ACA actually transfers much of the regulation of health insurance to the federal government. This is really a very dramatic change from how health insurance has been regulated in the past. You know, up at least since the mid-19th century, states have been the primary regulators of insurance. And that, and in fact, in 1868, there was a Supreme Court case that came out and basically said the insurance is not commerce, and therefore it should be within the realm of the state. And that sort of held all the way through until the 1940s, when the federal government tried to regulate insurance through their antitrust laws. And when all of that happened, the regulation of insurance really kind of blew up, because the Supreme Court did decide at that point that the regulation of insurance was interstate commerce and was subject to federal power. And at that time, the Congress actually decided to take a step back and say, okay, we do have the power to regulate insurance, but they passed the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which largely left the states in charge just as they had been in charge over the past 75 years prior to that. And since then, our states have been in charge of the regulation of insurance until the passage of the ACA. Now, of course, since then, the federal government has sort of picked some issues that they thought were important, and they have directed states to regulate these insurance issues and directed them in certain directions. For instance, all states now, before the ACA, have to offer guaranteed renewable insurance plans, and that was a product of HIPAA back in 1996. Now, the ACA itself also transfers the financial responsibility to the federal government in regards to many of our low-income people that we provide care for. And a lot of that has to do with the Medicaid expansion, but it also has to do with the new provision of federal insurance subsidies. Now, as we think about this, the federal health care law and what it does to moving in the federal regulation of health insurance towards the federal government is really becomes a huge issue, because the regulation of health care is a very, very personal matter. It's a very personal matter, and generally speaking, when we're looking at a lot of these personal matters, anything as intimate as a person's health care should really be ideally addressed at a local level by officials that are accessible and answerable to the people. Putting the regulation of health insurance in more distant federal hands may not turn out to be in the best interest of Minnesotans. And so as we move through this session and think about the ACA, we really need to think about making sure that the state of Minnesota keeps that lead, and keeps that lead as we're moving forward, and keeps that leadership role in protecting the health care of our citizens. And we can do that in a number of ways. We've already seen a number of states that have pursued healthcare lawsuits, and they've really taken a dramatic step. And last Monday, a federal court just struck down the entire piece of legislation because it ruled that the individual mandate violated the Constitution. It was a step too far. Now, that's a pretty dramatic thing for the state of Minnesota to do, and we have chosen not to do that. But I also want to mention that it's really important as we move forward to think of ourselves as that. But I also want to mention that it's really important as we move forward to think of ourselves as counsel to the federal government. Think of ourselves as people who can guide wise decisions by the federal government. We don't want to give up our power to be able to decide for the citizens of Minnesota what is a good healthcare policy, what is a good health insurance policy. We want, so I think we can still, even under this legislation, I think we can still be a powerful guide to those in Washington as we move forward. Now, with that, I want to offer you a quote by Mark Pauley. Mark Pauley is a professor at the Wharton School. And this quote refers to the Massachusetts plan, and the federal healthcare legislation was largely modeled on the Massachusetts plan. And the quote goes, the Massachusetts fix highlights one of the downsides of any incremental reform. Unavoidably mind-numbing detail, fully known only by the people who managed the old system and designed the new one. I offer this quote for two reasons. First, this quote demonstrates the fact that after I've just talked about how the federal role has expanded and shifted and moved in dramatic ways, this healthcare law is still just an incremental move from where we've been. We're changing things at the margins. We keep changing things at the margins. And also, I also kind of wanted to offer this quote because as I move forward through this, and maybe you're already experiencing this, but this can get very mind-numbing as we're talking through these issues. And as we talk through these issues throughout the session, because we're looking at all the details of the old system, seeing how all the details move towards the new system, it can get mind-numbing. And first off, that's not my fault here, as I'm sitting here, and your minds might start getting numb. So don't blame me, but this is something that is a difficult process and will be a difficult process moving forward as we start looking at all these different increments that are changing within the healthcare legislation. So with that, I do want to dive into the meat of what's going on here and start talking about the impacts on Medicaid. And as I move forward through these various issues, I'll be starting with looking at some opportunities that the state of Minnesota has under federal legislation. And then I'll move on to some challenges that the federal healthcare legislation presents in all these different areas. So to begin with Medicaid opportunities, these opportunities include, one, the ACA really does create the opportunity to move low-income working adults and families from Minnesota Care to private health plans. We've talked about the federal health care subsidies for low-income adults. These subsidies are offered to people that are currently in, that will be offered to people that are currently in our Minnesota Care program. And these subsidies really offer a great opportunity to move from what really has become an expensive program that doesn't afford real financial protections to people. As I'm assuming most of you know, the Minnesota Care program has a limit of $10,000 on hospitalizations. These new private health plans will not have that sort of limit, and they will also pay doctors a private pay wage. They won't pay the low reimbursement rates that our Medicaid program pays. And I think another really important aspect of this is that when you move from Minnesota Care to private health plans, you also are able to have a lot more portability with your health plan. Your health plan, when your income rises, you're not forced to abandon your health plan. You're not forced to abandon Minnesota Care. You're actually able to move into your new income status, your higher income status, with the same health plan. And when you have the same coverage moving forward, you're more likely to have more continuous care. This has been shown in various research in different states that have had premium supports in place versus our Minnesota Care program. There are also opportunities to improve Medicaid. As we look at Minnesota Care possibly fading away and being replaced by these federal health care subsidies, the Medicaid program will become more targeted at a poor population. And I think when you start looking at this targeting towards a poor population, I think we're going to be able to focus on this poor population. And I think this is an important point because, you know, year after year, when we're going through a lot of these issues and thinking about the budget issues, too often that Minnesota Care population, that higher income, low income working adult population, is what we would debate about. Where can we move that income level? Where can we move the benefit level for this population of people? And if we can stop debating that issue, I think that is a huge opportunity to start focusing on keeping the program for the people that really need it a well-functioning program. And in that regard, as far as ideas that can promote, that we can promote, that will improve that program. The ACA does include demonstration projects that improve on what Minnesota's already doing. For example, there's a Medicaid, a medical home project. Now, this project is focused on Medicare, but it attaches to the Medicaid proposals that we've been moving forward. And by attaching Medicare to this, to these programs, it really gives, it could give a real boon to actually paying providers to coordinate certain care under this medical home concept. The a second great example is our global payment demonstrations. These global payment demonstrations can be a way to pay for the GAMC compromise that we reached recently and actually pay for it adequately. The GAMC compromise basically introduced a total cost of care idea into to pay for very, very low-income people. And I agree with Steve Parenti that this total cost of care, accountable care organization idea isn't necessarily the best idea for the rest of us in this room, but when it comes to the low-income people in Minnesota, this actually has been showing some real positive results to actually create the incentives and giving incentives to providers to actually go out and meet people's needs instead of waiting for people to come to their emergency room. Of course, there are going to be challenges under this new proposal under Medicaid. To begin, the ACA will likely reduce the state's flexibility in modifying and improving its Medicaid program. You know, over the ever since Clinton opened up the waiver process a little bit more, we've seen a lot of action at the state level on waivers and introducing new ideas to create a, you know, better Medicaid program. And a lot of those ideas were consumer-driven, patient-driven ideas. A couple examples that we've had these ideas working through in Indiana and in Florida, and they've been showing some very positive results. However, these ideas might not make it under the current administration. They might not make it under the current ACA. Because when you look at the ACA, when you read that legislation, it moves away from the demonstration projects that are included in there, move away from this consumer-driven, patient-centered focus. And they focus on a more top-down approach. They focus on attempting to control the delivery of healthcare through changing how Medicaid pays providers. And that's the total cost of care approach, which does work for some people in Medicaid, but might not work for other people in Medicaid. This is an and issue. We need to be looking at everything. We can't just be looking at these top-down controls. We need to be looking at empowering people with health opportunity accounts like we have in Indiana, where they're actually given money to be able to control their own care. And another challenge is the fact that Minnesota will continue to receive substantially lower federal Medicaid matching rates. We've always had this happen, and moving forward, we're still going to continue receiving lower federal Medicaid matching rates. The Urban Institute predicts that in 2019 we'll be number 4 in the country as far as our matching rate is concerned. That does strain our budget. Also, moving forward, Medicaid enrollment will be expected to increase in Minnesota. This increase could actually be quite a bit higher than a lot of people might be predicting, and I think for about 4 different reasons. First, the enrollment process will be simplified. Simplified enrollment process will bring in a lot more people. A lot of people expect that that will make it a lot easier to sign up, so more people will sign up. We don't really know what that impact is going to be. And it's really hard to estimate exactly what that enrollment process will do. And in addition to that, you've got the individual mandate. You're going to get more information out there. You're going to be more pressure to sign up for something. And if you're going to sign up for something, a lot of people will sign up for Medicaid. And then there's the elimination of the asset test. Medicaid today has an asset test and an income test. Moving forward, in 2014, there will no longer be an asset test in Medicaid. We will be moving exclusively to an income-based test for qualifications for most of the Medicaid program. There is an asset test for certain parts of the Medicaid program, including our long-term care program and some other programs, but for working adults and for people who need it for income reasons, it's really going to be an income-based test. Employers will also be dropping coverage. This is a big if. We have no idea what is going to be happening in the employer marketplace. As I'll discuss a little bit later on, there's a lot of rules and regulations that we just don't know. We don't know how those rules and regulations are going to be applied to employers. We just don't know the definitions, the extent, the burdens that those are really going to place on employers moving forward. And really the gist of all that is that there's a lot of uncertainty in regards to what the increase is going to be to our Medicaid program. And we need to be prepared for, I think, some higher increases than we're expecting. Lastly, as far as the challenges are concerned with the Medicaid program, I really think we need to keep our mind focused on the fact that this is a federal program with federal financial obligations, and while there might not be a very substantial impact on the state budget, as I'll talk about later, federal spending is going to increase remarkably under this program, under the ACA. And we, as a state, need to keep that in mind as we move forward with policies that take off on the ACA, to make sure that we're doing it responsibly, to make sure that we're not overburdening future generations with the impact of increased federal spending. Now I'd like to discuss a little bit about the impact on the insurance market. I do believe there are some opportunities within the insurance market. The insurance exchange may help promote individually owned health insurance, which I think can have a lot of benefits to our health plan marketplace. Right now, most people, if they get insurance, they get it through their employers, and or they get it through the government. And for a lot of employers, that works out real well. But for a lot of employers, that doesn't work out real well. For small employers, it's a very expensive product. Small employers don't have the capacity to deal with the human services demands. They're not necessarily interested in going out and shopping for a health plan to meet the needs of all of their employees. An easier process for them is to simply make a choice that instead of defining your benefits, I'm going to define the contribution that I'm willing to pay for your benefits. So they can set a contribution of, say, $2,000, $3,000, and just say, look, you're going to have $3,000, go buy your own health plan. And right with the insurance exchange, they're going to have a place to go find a health plan with that defined contribution arrangement, and where they will be able to shop for a plan, have a choice over a plan, and this will create portability, because once they buy that plan in that marketplace, when they lose their job, ideally this will be an individual market plan, and they will be able to keep that plan and move on to another job and possibly use the next employer's defined contribution to pay for the same plan they had at their previous employer. And again, the portable plan has continuous coverage, which means continuous care and better health care for everybody. Now, more choice for people within the small group coverage also hopefully will beget a more competitive and innovative health plan marketplace. The fact that we rely on employers for our health insurance, I believe, has really reduced the amount of competition that is in our health plan marketplace. And the reason why is because when an employer goes out and decides the insurance plan, they have to look at their entire employee population. They have to make a decision to find one plan that meets everybody's needs. And one plan isn't necessarily the best for everybody. Instead of having one plan that meets everybody's needs, it seems to me a far better arrangement to give every employee their own defined contribution and have them go out in the marketplace and find the health plan product that best meets their needs. Another opportunity through the implementation of the ACA, and this is also linked back to the insurance exchanges and more individual ownership over your health plans, is that people with expensive chronic conditions might actually find that health plans actively compete to offer them a high-quality product. Right now, there's really no incentive for health plans to go out and compete for a chronically ill person, because they'll all of a sudden accumulate a lot of extra costs associated with that person, because chronic illnesses and have higher costs. It's a very simple equation. And they can also, in our marketplace right now, deny coverage to those people. And when they deny those that coverage, they go into a high-risk pool. And going into that high-risk pool has been actually a very good solution for our state. And it's actually worked quite well. However, once you go into that high-risk pool, that's your choice. You don't have any choice over what your health plan product is. We contract with Medica to provide that service, and that's your choice. It would be a much better situation if health plans actually competed for those people with chronic illnesses and designed plans that actually met their needs in a more innovative and creative way than we have right now. And the way that this actually might happen is through changing the risk adjustment process, through actually implementing a risk adjustment process like we have in our Medicare program for our Medicare Advantage plans. When a person entering Medicare signs up for a plan, the health insurance plan that they choose gets paid on the front end an extra fee, and that fee covers the extra expense that they expect from their chronic illness or whatever other illness that they expect to increase expenses for that health plan. And so they're actually compensated, and it becomes this is an opportunity, but it's also, as I'll talk about later, a challenge, because we have experience right now with Medicare in risk adjustment, but risk adjustment could possibly pose problems in the future.
Mr. Nelson, I just want to let you know we have about 5 minutes left for the presentation, and then we'll have about 10 minutes for questions.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to challenges with the health insurance market, we're looking at we have to look at premiums and understand that under the ACA, premiums are going to continue to outpace inflation. As Dr. Parenti said, this legislation does not do very much to control costs. In fact, by adding certain insurance regulations, it will increase costs, and I believe we've already seen that it's increasing costs. The HHS estimates that the ban on lifetime limits on the dollar value of coverage will raise premiums by 0.5 to 1%. HHS estimates that the requirement to cover certain preventive health care services will raise premiums by 1.5%. Now, the federal government must also define an essential benefit set, and we don't know what that definition is going to be yet. They've just started that process. And the essential benefit set could be more substantial than the average healthcare product that's out there. It'll at least be more expensive than a lot of the choices that are out there right now that are more affordable choices. And that could have a serious impact on the availability of affordable health plans for lower-income Minnesotans. The individual market premiums will also see large premium increases because the individual market right now has been largely shielded from high premiums because a lot of the high-risk folks go into our high-risk pool. And if you're in the small group market, we require small groups to cover you regardless of your risk, and so a lot of the risk is bound up in that small group marketplace too. We're talking about combining those markets right now, and that will have an impact on insurance premiums for individuals. I won't talk about medical loss ratios right now because Dr. Parenti certainly mentioned those, and we can talk about those maybe a little in the questions and answers. I'll also say that there is no guarantee that the new insurance regulations that require insurers to cover people with pre-existing conditions will be an improvement on Minnesota's high-risk pool. Minnesota has a great concept right now with the high-risk pool. We may find, moving forward, that creating a health insurance exchange that requires the insurance companies that operate in that exchange to cover you, we may find that is a better arrangement. We may find that the risk adjustment arrangements that we figure out for that health insurance exchange work, and they work quite well. However, we don't know. And again, that really goes to the importance of allowing different states to pursue different ideas and let states test these ideas out. And that's what we've been doing for the past 100, 150 years. And that is an approach that I believe we should continue moving forward, but the ACA doesn't allow that. Now, lastly, as far as the challenges are concerned for the insurance market, instead of switching to a defined contribution health plan that promotes individual ownership, many employers may find that it's a better idea to switch to a self-insured arrangement. Now, self-insured arrangement is normally how large employers insure themselves. Large employers pay for it out of their own pocket. They don't pay an insurance company, they pay a third-party administrator that also happens to be an insurance company. And the employers that are offering, that are moving to the self-insured arrangement are getting smaller and smaller and smaller each day. And because these self-insured arrangements are not subject to all of the ACA provisions, we may find that a lot of smaller employers are actually going to move to this sort of arrangement, and which, in my opinion, will move a lot of these problems that we have with our employer-based insurance system will just keep moving forward. It's not going to solve those problems. Finally, I'll end here with some impacts on employers that we should expect. Opportunity-wise, there's not that much to speak of, I don't think. When we look at the employers, they have the opportunities to switch the defined benefit plan to the defined contribution plan. That is a good idea. However, there are a number of challenges, and I believe that Dr. Parenti really outlined a lot of these challenges as far as administrative challenges and a lot of the new rules. The mandate on employers applies to employers across the board. There is no special exemptions for retailers or restaurants, and that one-size approach is going to be harmful to different sectors of our economy more so than others. Employers will also have much less flexibility over designing a cost-effective health plan. Many employers may weigh the cost of this less flexibility and higher premiums with the cost of federal penalties and choose to drop coverage. Very few small businesses will qualify for the small business tax credits, and is only available for 6 years. These small business tax credits are not going to be continuing on. While current plans are grandfathered in, most businesses are expected to drop their grandfathered coverage, and there are a bunch of new taxes, and these taxes are on high income earners, and as I'm sure we'll debate this year, these high income earners are also small business owners. And these will have tremendous impacts on small business owners because their small business income. I do want to, I suppose, quickly address some of these issues with the state budget, because I think there are opportunities here, so I'm going to end on a more positive note. We should see less impact on our state budget than other states do, because our state already is very generous with these plans. And so when you look at the fact that we're able to move from our Minnesota Care enrollees into a federally subsidized plan, we will find, I think, a large drop in what we're spending on Minnesota Care. In addition to that, these new enrollees that we bring into our Medicaid program will likely be healthier. We already provide care for a lot of people that are the sickest people. The people that are outside the system are probably healthier. And lastly, Minnesota will be able to extend Minnesota right now extends Medicaid to higher income levels, and the state can potentially save money by reducing this eligibility. This is possible because the ACA partially waives maintenance of effort requirements for states with fiscal problems. In regards to the state budget, there are still challenges. Medicaid enrollment may increase more than expected, as I already discussed. And also, as I already discussed, there's likely less flexibility to redesign Medicaid programs to address the long-term budget problems that Minnesota is facing. With that, I will end my presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nelson. We have a question, Representative Grunhagen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nelson, I appreciate your presentation. I agree with many of your conclusions, but just two comments here. First, I believe you're correct in stating it was based on the Massachusetts model. Also, you have two statements inside here on impact. It says, more importantly, very little in the ACA addresses the two key cost drivers, the tax code and Medicare. Secondly, medical loss ratios may eliminate small insurance companies and new entrants from the insurance market. Well, we already see that in Massachusetts, where we're seeing fewer insurance companies, higher cost, and increasing premiums. So the net result is that because the 2,700-page bill did not address these key cost drivers along with medical malpractice insurance, we basically are setting ourselves up for where the this type of plan is going to bankrupt the private health insurance companies. Already, we already see Medicare and Medicaid head towards bankruptcy. So this is going to simply bankrupt the private health insurance companies, and then that's going to result in a single-payer plan, and then we can all go bankrupt. Do you agree with those comments, Mr. Nelson?
Before Mr. Nelson responds to that, I just want to let members know that you're right now some testimony that has been prepared from some folks on this issue are being handed out to you. So that's what you're receiving right now. And Mr. Nelson, if you want to respond to that statement.
Thank you. Representative Gruenhagen, yes, we may find some people being bankrupted by all of these new regulations and new demands on the system. However, I think it's important to look at insurance. It's where it's going to be us. It's going to be us, the individuals that are going out and buying insurance that might be bankrupted. The insurance companies are going to pass costs on to us. When you look at all these issues, you've got to understand that all these costs are getting passed on to us. And insurance companies are going to continue raising premiums, and they'll have the power to raise premiums. Yes, there's rate review, but you know, I don't believe we're going to bankrupt these companies. These companies are still going to be around, but they're going to be charging exorbitant fees. And I share your concern that when they start charging these exorbitant fees, and they prove that, yeah, they'll prove by their accounting that these fees are reasonable under their business model, we're going to start seeing some. We might see an advance towards saying, hey, look, this isn't working. We need a different system. And then right now we may set up the framework for the government to start controlling this system even more than it already does.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up.
Yes, Representative Gruenhagen.
Yeah, and, you know, it's government reimbursement rates currently that are also hurting our hospital doctors and hospitals in terms of their losses and cost shifting to the insurance company. To the private insurance companies. You couple that with the fact that the public has a certain point where they're not going to accept these higher premiums, and they're going to start crying for a single payer plan. And in my opinion, the whole ACAA is designed to lead to a single payer plan, which is what they want in the first place. And that is going to be a travesty with health care rationing, and something that I don't think we want, any of us want, for our children and grandchildren in the future. Thank you, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Nelson.
President Gruenhagen, I certainly agree with you that there's that risk moving forward. And I have a hard time believing that this was designed with that in mind. I think a lot of people threw a lot of stuff in a bill, and it became 2,700 pages, and we have what we have due to that process. But you're right. If this doesn't work, then what's the alternative? And that's really, you know, when I get back to what is the state role, what's the federal role? The states have always taken on this responsibility. And because the states have taken on this responsibility, the consequences of failure have been distributed across 50 states. The consequences of failure in this instance is failure of the entire healthcare, how we operate with our entire health insurance system. And to me, that is a serious risk, and we, of course, need to be watchful of that.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nelson. Boy, it's hard to know where to begin here. I mean, you know, let me sort of start at the end. This hand-wringing about rationing, I thought Dr. Parenti was kind of saying that, you know, if you had these high deductible plans, in a way you would be rationing, that we sort of have to ration because you can't, you know, that's one way of thinking. It's not my way of thinking, but that you have to somehow, you know, the only way to do this is if somebody doesn't get care. That's rationing. So, you know, you want to say the ACA is rationing? I guess anything that you don't like, you call it rationing. But, you know, I think that, you know, the idea here is to give people care that they need when they need it, so hopefully more expensive care can be eliminated. So that's how I think the ACA is attempting to make care affordable. And but, you know, I just wanted to address kind of directly sort of the one of the underlying premises of your presentation here, and, you know, even just... you've said a number of times you're concerned about federal control over what used to be state control and so on. And I guess I would really challenge that premise, because first of all, we've got Medicare, which has been, you know, in place for many, many years, and that is a federal program. There's no question about it. We don't do anything with that here. And there are many other things besides health care that are run, you know, by the feds. You know, looking at your quote you've given us here about, you know, the mind-numbing detail, you know, that's a lot of things have mind-numbing detail. We just don't all usually worry about them. For example, there's a highway system out there. Now, do I know the specs for building a highway? No, I do not. Do I care to know? No. To me, that would be mind-numbing detail. But I know that I can get on Highway 52 and go home to Rochester, and that's pretty much all I need, you know? So from the consumer's point of view, the fact that there's mind-numbing detail somewhere in the back office, that's fine. I think in any business, there's mind-numbing detail in the back office that the consumer at the front table doesn't need to know. So I don't think that's really a problem, as long as we've got smart people that understand and specialize in these things and can figure them out. And then, you know, the one question that I had for you about this, you talked a lot about the possible detriment to small businesses and so on, and I had understood that there were tax credits for small businesses in this bill and in this law, and that was going to help with the cost of providing care for employees. Am I wrong about that?
Mr. Nielsen.
Representative Levy, thank you for your comments, and you're not wrong that there are tax credits in the bill. However, the tax credits are limited. They're limited to employers that I believe have an average salary of less than $50,000 for their employees, and they're also limited on a time element. They're limited for, I believe, 6 years. So, you know, small businesses, if you ask the National Federation of Independent Businesses what they think about the small business tax credit, you know, they're not real excited about it. They don't say this is a boon to small business. Now, as regards to your comments regarding the federal role and the state role, you're right. The federal government has played a strong role in the healthcare system. However, the states, since as long as states have really been around, have controlled the regulation of insurance and have been there to protect people, to be that protector for people at the state level, and it's been mostly a state effort, and when it's closer to the people, it's going to be, I believe, a system that's more responsive to the people. And when in something that's as personal as your health care, I think we need that. I think we're moving away from that personal attention to the people to a federal system that is going to be less responsive, and that concerns me. That really does concern me.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. Members, this has been great discussion, some great idea starters, and we will, Representative Murphy, continue this conversation as a committee. I certainly hope so. That's part of our charge, I think. I want to thank our testifiers and all the members for the good conversation and information today. We stand adjourned.